Blog Talk Radio.
Best-selling and award-winning author of true crime and crime fiction, Yvonne Mason is back with a brand new book, The Pink Canary, a book that delves into the life of a drag queen and a marvelous whodunit. You can find this and all of Yvonne's other works on Amazon.com or find Yvonne Mason on Facebook and Twitter.
You're gonna kill me.
Buy your copy of Pink Canary now.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Off the Chain, and I am your host, Yvonne Mason. And it looks like that my guest, author Linda DeLeon, for whatever reason, did not call in tonight. So guess what we're going to do tonight, ladies and gentlemen? We are having an open mic night. It's just one of those nights on a Saturday night where, because we can. What I'll be doing is I'll be playing some music. I have put up the phone number. It's 516-387-1756. We'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. And I'll talk about some few things because there's been some things weighing heavily on my mind as we talked about the other night when I did the show. And the fact that I am working on some true crimes and helping some new friends of mine who have lost loved ones in the state of Mississippi, and especially in Harrison County. And there are some serious, serious questions I have about the deaths being ruled suicide, undetermined. They can't get any information out of the coroner there. His name's Harry Hargrove. The police departments are not cooperating at all. And it makes me wonder, the criminal justice person inside of me, as most of you all know, I do have a background in criminal justice. I was a bounty hunter before I moved to Florida. I still hunt people, but not like I did in Georgia, because I have to be a bail bondsman, and I am not going to be a bail bondsman. I don't want to bond people out of jail. I want to put them back in there. So when I get these stories from these families who have lost loved ones in Harrison County, and I'm hearing the same thing from each one. And these people didn't even know each other. They just hooked up after they all had a common theme, and the theme was they lost loved ones in Harrison County, Mississippi, which is right on the Gulf. Those of y'all who know the Gulf know it's Biloxi, Gulfport, and Pass Christian. Time that one of these victims died, the coroner came back and said, oh, it was suicide. Well, please, people, you can't have that many damn suicides in one city. It just doesn't work that way. And when you don't work a crime scene like it's supposed to be worked, and you walk in and walk out and say, oh, it's suicide, let me tell you what. Anybody worth their salt in law enforcement, in crime scene investigation, hell, even in the damn coroner's office, anybody who is worth their salt works the scene like it is a crime until said time that it is proven otherwise. And the definition of a suicide is it is illegal to commit suicide. The only problem is there's nobody to prosecute because the person is no longer living. So it is considered a homicide. So you work the scene like a homicide. You start from the exterior and you make a grid. You send out people to interview people. You look for physical evidence on the exterior before you ever go inside to work the interior. You take so many damn photographs that you want to throw up. You not only take photographs, you take video. You don't let people just wander around in the crime scene and contaminate it. Doesn't work that way. You don't draw conclusions, especially with a gunshot victim, until you've done a full autopsy, because there's evidence in the body. The dead do speak to us, ladies and gentlemen. They really do. I'm telling you, you just have to listen. So let's see who's on the phone. Hello, this is Yvonne. May I help you?
Hey, Yvonne, this is Phyllis. How are you?
I'm fine, baby. How are you?
I'm hanging in. Got to be tough, as they say.
That is so true.
I feel like I'm fading fast.
Well, no, you're not fading fast. We're just getting started, honey. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Phyllis Cook. She is one of the victims' families that I was talking about. And when a coroner signs a death certificate in Phyllis's case, when the coroner signs her brother's death certificate that he killed himself with a .410 shotgun, but there's no evidence of the .410 shotgun, no shell casings, no bullet fragments, no expelled bullet out of the shell casing, that's a problem. Because what he did is he took someone else's statement that it was a .410. Well, the investigator in me says, show me the evidence. Because if that were to ever get to court, there's no way in hell anybody would be prosecuted and convicted because there's no evidence. You cannot take it on the word of someone else that, oh, he killed himself with a .410, but I don't know where the gun is because it's not here. That duck does not hunt. It doesn't work that way, ladies and gentlemen. And this is just one of the four cases that these wonderful people gave to me. And it's like I told them, we may never, ever, ever get it back into a court of law, but these victims and their families will have justice through their stories that are going to be told in the books, because I'm telling you, it's the tip of the iceberg. And the more, it's like I said on my Facebook post, the more I dig, the worse it gets. So, Phyllis, I know under the law, you are entitled, and I posted that in our group page, you are entitled to all information that has to do with your brother and your father. Under the law, they have to give it to you. They can stonewall you, but you file subpoenas, and you get whatever information that they have, and they will lie and tell you they don't have it. But when they have a subpoena, but with a subpoena, they have to provide it. Now, I know in your brother's case, they said, well, Hurricane Katrina destroyed all the records. I'm sorry, but that dog doesn't hunt either.
No, you're right. Because, you know, they told me I called for 36 years. I knew it was Jeffrey Bass. He was the only one listed in the obituary. You know, and I'm not saying alleged. I did say alleged, and I guess for legal purposes, you know, you have to say alleged or, you know, it's my personal opinion. So I will say alleged in my personal opinion, but I'll also say it's my personal knowledge that Jeffrey Dennis Bass was the only one with my brother at the time he was shot, along with a girl named Kathy that we never was able to obtain her last name. The night before my brother was killed, I mean, the night before my brother was buried, this little girl calls, and she's screaming and crying, and she's saying, he killed him, he killed him. But we never found out her last name. So for 36 years, I know that Gulfport Sheriff's Department, and I'm saying the Sheriff's Department for a special reason, but Gulfport Sheriff's Department would tell me, we're working on it, ma'am, we'll get back with you, or someone will call you back. They never sent me anything. I realize now why. Is because in 2013, I found out it was due to the fact of the corruption with the Dixie Mafia and the involvement with the Harrison County Sheriff's Department and most of any judicial system in the Gulfport area. I mean, whether it be the DA, the police, the sheriff, you know, and it's public knowledge. This is not something that I'm making a false accusation or a slanderous accusation against anyone. This is public knowledge.
And the thing is, Phyllis, we all, those of us that have the background that I have and the background that my husband has and the background of the gentleman that will be here Monday to go over the information that I have so far that you sent me, by looking at the information and by the stonewalling of the lack of information, it doesn't just stop with the sheriff's department, the coroner's office, the DA, and from the people that I've talked to that have also lost people in that county, it goes all the way up the ladder. There is palm handing from one to the other, and it goes all the way up higher than just the local boys.
You're right. It sure does. I call the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation with our Alan Thompson, and I spoke with him, and his exact words were, he was the cold case investigation with the Mississippi Bureau of Investigations. He told me that he was sorry, but after 49 years, he just didn't see where there was going to be anything to investigate. This is before he even picked up a pencil and paper to take my name. You know, once I told him who and where and what was involved, it's like, I'm sorry, ma'am, but there's nothing here. We're not going to be able to find anything attitude. And that was the attitude he has maintained until today. He has sent me nothing, and he has not returned my calls.
And
they
won't.
I have several emails. No, they won't. And the coroner, this has been my third request that went out asking for stuff on my brother. He tells me he didn't handle it. He has nothing. The clerk's office, the DA's office, the Jackson office, I got the death certificate from there. But as far as the Mississippi Sheriff's Department, Police Department, they have sent me nothing and will not. I have papers that I sent to you that is stamped in big red letter, denied. They denied the information on my brother, and they denied the information on my daddy. They finally did send a few, but it was nothing.
So now your next step, Phyllis, because the information that I put up on our group page today is mm-hmm. you send a FOIA request to the state, because they have to keep those records. If they deny you that FOIA request, then you get an attorney to get you in front of a judge and have that judge subpoena those papers, because you are entitled, as the victim's family member, you are entitled to all of those records. They cannot keep them from you.
Okay.
So if you're denied this time, you get a FOIA request for the state for both your brother and your father.
Okay. And the reason I say I know that there's such a cover up is whenever on my dad's case of 2003, I was told there was no witnesses whatsoever. From time 2003 up to a couple of months ago, there were no witnesses, is what I was being told. And then all of a sudden, whenever I did threaten to take them to court and tell them that the attorney would be getting back with them, they sent me a copy of an autopsy report that I already had. They sent me the narrative reports and a couple of other reports. And what was so ironic is they have four witnesses there, two stating that they were walking the dog over a couple of streets over, and they heard gunshots, one single gunshot, 15 to 20 minutes before the police arrived. If they're on the other scene, how do they know when? So I've tried to contact those people, look them up under people search, everything. There is no name. So how ironic that they got, and I explained this to Captain Pearson, I guess they got blown away with Katrina also. I think they were fabricated people. He's not given me anything to contact those people whatsoever. Just like with Jeffrey Bass for 50 years, nobody knew him. Nobody could contact him. Finally, after about 6 months, Captain Pearson told me that he'd rather me not speak to anyone else, that he'd prefer I quit calling the Sheriff's Department or the Police Department, harassing everybody, and just speak only to him. Well, for 6 months, I've dealt with him, and I've gotten no further than I have 50 years ago, except for the fact of 2 weeks ago, whenever he saw on my page that I had posted a picture of Jeffrey Bass and that people were offering to help me. He came forward and told me, all of a sudden, he's found my dad's car, and it was sold in July, the first time of 2002. My dad was killed in April, and then it was changed hands in November. My dad's car was there in November of 2002 because I was at my dad's. So that I know is a lie. And then he said, and Miss Cook, I found Jeffrey Bass. I said, you found Jeffrey Bass? He said, yes, ma'am, but it's not the picture that you posted on your Facebook. I said, yes, it is. He said, oh, no, ma'am, it's not. Well, I let him talk, and he said that this Jeffrey Bass admitted that he was with Ronnie. He admitted that he was the only one there, and that the gun he did not think had a firing pin in it. He did not think the gun would fire. So he ran upstairs when the gun went off and shot Ronnie and got a nurse. Well, this nurse that he's using the term of a nurse, that was what I put in my stuff, and that's what I have told from when my brother was murdered in 1967 until now, that the nurse was my stepmother. She was married to my dad. They were divorced, and it's Jeffrey Bass's aunt. And he ran and he called her. She came over, and they cleaned up everything, bathed Ronnie. You know, this is not something that I just told. So this is something that he fabricated of a nurse being upstairs as a still a cover-up. There was no nurse that lived upstairs. And then
well,
the fact
that there was never a weapon found at the scene. There was no indications. There were never any spent bullets. There were never any gun fragments. There were. I'm not even sure if. Okay, let's say for the sake of this discussion, Phyllis, let's just say that your brother shot himself. Okay, that spent bullet had to go somewhere. If he put the gun up under his chin, as he said he did, and shot him, that bullet was gone straight up into the ceiling and lodged there or ricocheted off. They never worked the crime scene. They never
and, you
found
know, even
anything.
If they, even if they did, I look back and say, well, you know, maybe they did get the gun, maybe they did get the shell casing, but because it was involving the Dixie Mafia, Roy Hobbs was the sheriff at the time. The coroner, I've just been recently told that there was indictments against the coroner because of the corruption and the suicide cover-ups that he did, that he was under federal indictment back then. And this came from someone that is involved with the Dixie Mafia that knew some of the stuff that was going on. I will not expose them at this point in time. But so the proof was there. They positively identified the picture as Jeffrey Bass. Yes, it was him. So, you know, I don't know where the gun is. I don't know if the police got the gun. I don't know if I'm assuming the gun was Jeffrey Bass's because my brother was murdered to keep him from leaving Mississippi and possibly telling some of the involvement within the Dixie Mafia and things that he had overheard. So, you know, at this point, I'm saying, where was the gun? So if this Jeffrey Bass came in a couple of weeks ago and he positively confessed to everything, then he should know where the gun is. He should know what happened to the gun and who the gun was listed. And this is something that Captain Peterson told out of his own mouth to me.
Well, there, in everything that I've read that you sent me, there was no weapon found.
Yep.
That's everything that you sent me. There was no weapon found. So if there's no weapon found, there's no evidence there, then how can a coroner who has no medical experience, who is not a doctor, who did not do an autopsy, can say with a certainty that he shot himself with a 410 shotgun? He cannot. He couldn't even say that in a court of law. Under oath.
And this was a 410 over and under double barrel shotgun.
And see, he cannot say with certainty that that is what happened. All he's got is what he was told. That is called hearsay. That would not hold up on a witness stand. If you do not have the evidence, you cannot say with certainty that's how someone died. Now, your brother very well probably did die from a 410 shotgun, but I don't think he did it.
No. No, Ronnie would not. You know, because, like I say, when my dad left there, Ronnie was getting his clothes packed and was happy I was coming to pick him up. I would have picked him up within just several hours. I'd already went to the grocery, got everything ready. All I was doing was coming back and getting everything ready at the house and waiting to, you know, if my husband get off work, we were going to pick him up. So, you know, Ronnie was happy he was coming to stay with me. My daddy was happy that he was getting Ronnie out of Mississippi and away from the corruption. Well, they made sure he didn't leave.
So the question begs to be answered is, did he tell someone that he was coming to your house? Who did
tell?
When did he tell them?
Well, he told Jeffrey Bass and them. They were there at the house when my daddy left. They were all there, Ronnie, Jeffrey. All of them were there at the house when Daddy took Ronnie's clothes and Ronnie was getting packed they knew about it the day before because I had called the day before, and Daddy had already told Ronnie the day before. So then Daddy went back over there that day that I was to pick him up and took him some money and some clothes so when I got there he would be ready to go. So they knew. They knew for 2 days Ronnie was leaving.
They being Jeffrey Bass and the alleged girlfriend.
Yes, and then whoever else that was around. I don't know. I was not there, so I can't say how many people would have known. But I know that those two did.
Okay, well, all right, let's take this scenario. When your father went and told Ronnie on the 25th that you were coming on the 26th to pick him up.
Mm-hmm.
Bass was there on the 25th, allegedly. Bass
yes.
had the opportunity to go and tell someone else that your brother was getting ready to leave. Now, that begs the question, what did they think that your brother knew?
Well, due to the fact that I have found pictures of my dad sitting at his kitchen table playing cards with Mike Gillick, Bobby Joe Faben, Carl Douglas, who is Towhead White, and Bill Rhodes, which I knew him as Pete Rhodes, all those at the table, then I know that my dad was associated with card playing and the gambling part of it because they were all at the house. Well, my brother living with my dad up until just a month or two before he was killed, I'm sure he's heard in quite a bit. I'm sure he has heard. And then being associated with Jeffrey Bass and Jeffrey Bass being a known member confirmed by the police department of Adam Cooper that he was a Dixie Mafia member. You know, I don't know what my brother heard or what the year and a half that my brother was there, what he knew or even to the point of, I guess, to go ahead and be honest, say, I don't know what he was involved in. I don't know if, you know, I don't think he was, but of course that would be me as a sister, my personal opinion. But then I had not heard anything, and nobody has come back and implicated him as being in trouble or being involved in anything or, you know, no one other than being a victim of association.
Would it have been possible that – now, ladies and gentlemen, for those of y'all who do not know who the Dixie Mafia are, the Dixie Mafia was and still is a loose-knit organization that runs the gambling casinos in Biloxi and in Gulfport and on into Louisiana, and they stretch into Texas. They're also in Chattooga County, Georgia. Yes, I've done my homework. They wanted to be like the boys out of New York, New Jersey, and up in that area. They wanted to be the mafia. So a bunch of ragtag men, good old boys, as we say in the South, homegrown, and they wanted to run the counties in which they lived in and the surrounding counties. So what they did, Gillick set up strip joints, set up gambling casinos, rousted the business people, I'm sure, for hush money and protection money, bought off the local law enforcement, bought off the local politicians, bought off anybody they could to keep them in their pockets, even had some lawyers in their pockets and some judges. So Phyllis's father was a bailiff for Judge Sherry. Was a bailiff for Judge Sherry, which was a local judge in that county. Judge Sherry and his wife were executed. That's another story within itself. They were executed in 1987. From 1980, and this was after Ronnie was executed, and we're going to go with that theory, in 1967. So that was a 20-year difference between the time Phyllis's brother Ronnie was killed and Judge Sherry and his wife was killed. And then 20 years later, Sherry's father was killed. So it begs to, and Ronnie was only 17 years old. He was a young teenager, and whether Sherry's father was just on the fringe, whether Jeffrey Bass was just on the fringe, whatever Ronnie saw or heard, they apparently didn't want it to get out. So when they found out that Ronnie was leaving, they wanted to make it look like a suicide. Now, if anybody has ever seen a 410 shotgun over under, which is a double barrel shotgun, it is very difficult to sit it between your legs and pull the trigger. Your arms have to be extremely long because those barrels are long. So the question begs to be asked, what did Ronnie know? When did he know it? What were they afraid of? Who put the hit out on him? And why did they wait another 20 years? Well, we know why they waited another 20 years to kill the judge and his wife. Then why did they wait till 2003 to kill Sherry's father? These are all questions that I'm asking. These are all questions Sherry has been asking because...
Now, Sherry...
I mean, I'm sorry, Phyllis. It's been that kind of day, darling.
Oh, honey,
Phyllis,
I understand.
I've been digging all day. I'm tired. These are the questions that Phyllis has been asking because the same coroner worked all three of those crime scenes. And Pete Hallett, who was an attorney, was in law practice with Judge Sherry. So all these people are interwoven in this county, and the more I dig, the worse it gets. Would that be a fair synopsis of what's going on?
Oh, yes, yes. And the corruption is still going on. I am not the only one. This corrupt coroner, there is Phil Swan with his son, Thad. There's Bonnie LeDoux with her daughter, Nikki. You know, these were... suicides. I mean, this family feels as positive that their family was murdered as much as I am with my, you know, brother Ronnie and Daddy. Now, Gary Hargrove did not cover the, as was not the coroner on my brother, but the coroner on my brother was Frank Hightower. And when I talked to one of the guys that was on the coroner's jury back in 97, I think it was, he told me, he said, little lady, he said, I barely remember that case. He said, but I told them I didn't think that boy committed suicide. He said, and I still don't. He said, but now Hightower was known as Suicide Hightower. Well, then I talked to a girl the other night, our person, and they told me that there was an indictment against him back during that time because of the suicides, that everything that came through, he had ruled him as so much as a suicide. Well, this is like Gary Hargrove. Gary Hargrove told me when I got there, he would not let me see my dad. And my dad and I were, close. I call my daddy every day. And I knew that I'd never heard Gary Hargrove's name. I knew he was not a bosom buddy of my dad's, or I would have heard him mentioned. And he tells me he wouldn't never let me see my dad's body. And when I got to the funeral home. So when I got, he told me that my, dad had committed suicide, and then he told me, well, my dad was going to jail for writing bad checks and for gambling expense and all. My dad didn't write bad checks. I kept my dad's checkbook and stuff and paid his bills. I knew this was a lie. Well, I called the judge that my daddy worked for, and when I did, he said, honey, who told you this? I was just a-crying, and I said, Gary Hargrove, and I said, he told me that my dad was going to jail for writing bad checks, that he had done and sold and pawned everything in his house of any value. And I thought, well, how, as a coroner, would he know this? Well, they were, most of the stuff was gone out of my dad's house. And now I cannot get a bank statement. There was so much of the stuff gone. My dad kept a big metal box that had the house papers and his car titles and everything in. Well, when he would come visit with us, first thing Daddy would do is throw that metal box in the trunk of the car, and he would keep it. So in case anything happened, he had all these important papers. That box was never found. That's how I feel like they stole the car. And Gary Hargrove, I'm saying, how, as a coroner, would he know what was in my dad's house, what had been stolen or gotten rid of, or what my dad was doing whenever he was only the coroner? He had never, what was he even doing in my dad's house and stuff? My dad had never mentioned him.
Those are all excellent questions because somebody knew and somebody was telling somebody who was telling him, and unless they were telling him themselves, or your father had been in that house.
No,
I mean, not your father, but Hargrove had been in that house. Yeah.
The coroner, I mean, yeah, but there was an attorney friend of my dad's, and now that I look back, everything makes sense and everything falls in place. His name was Roy Strickland, and Roy Strickland and my dad had been buddies for as long as I could remember. I mean, way back in the 70s and 80s, I'd call, and Daddy and Roy Strickland were either going to the AA clubs or they was going over to Wiggins to play poker or they was going to the casino. Roy had even been to my house several times. In 2002, my daddy had a kidney removed for cancer, I think it was his left kidney. And Roy Strickland called, and one night he was just asking, he said, well, Dan's not talking all goofy and saying crazy things, is he, honey? I said, Roy, you know, Daddy, I said, Daddy always says crazy stuff. Didn't know what he meant by then, but then I've been told that they say when you have major surgery or you're on high medication like Daddy, that you'll talk out of your head or you'll say things that are bothering you. So that's why he kept calling me, asking me. Well, when Daddy was in the hospital and he was having his kidney removed, because my mother died on April the 29th. I buried my mother on a Saturday. I came home on a Sunday. I worked Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday I left, drove to Mississippi, had my daddy at the hospital for pre-op to have his kidney removed for cancer. And then I took my dad back as soon as he got okay to stay with me for, you know, till I could get him on his feet. So while I was at the hospital, I was exhausted. I really was. And this Roy Strickland, he wrote on a little piece of paper, and I still have this note. It was one of those big bandages. He said, honey, we must get you some help. He said, you are exhausted. He said, you're so tired you can't even think. Well, he had asked me, he said, I'll take you out to dinner. He said, let me take you to dinner tonight. Well, I would have thought no more about going to dinner with Roy Strickland than I would my dad. He was my dad's age or maybe older. You know, that he was like a daddy figure to me. I thought a lot of Roy. Honey, when he left, my daddy, and my daddy was still sedated a lot. My daddy heard him ask, and my daddy told me, he said, Phyllis Elaine, and my dad never called me Phyllis Elaine. It was just always Dickens. He said, Phyllis Elaine, he said, don't you go nowhere with that SOB. Do you hear me? I said, yes, sir. He said, I'm telling you, he said, don't you go nowhere with him. He said, he'll hurt you, and he'll hurt you bad. And I did not know what my dad meant. It never, I was thinking Dad was just medicated up. Now I know what my dad meant.
And see, ladies and gentlemen, this quagmire keeps getting deeper and deeper. And this is just one of the stories. Phyllis talked about Bonnie LeDoux's daughter.
Nikki, yes.
And I
asked them to call in. I text them quick and ask them if they'd call in. I don't know if they're out because it's Friday, or hopefully they'll call in.
I have that case file, ladies and gentlemen, and there's no way on earth that that young woman shot herself. Looking at the few crime scene photos that they took, it took them an hour and a half to determine it was suicide. There's no way she killed herself. She couldn't have. If she did, she's a better contortionist than I ever thought about being. These are just two. Then there's another one. A young man by the name of Ted Swan was found in a ditch with no shoes, no socks, face down in a ditch that they were redoing that had broken rebar and cement in it. And it was found by a construction crew. He'd been there for 13 days. But his shoes and his socks were gone. And because he was in full decomp, they could not determine what we call COD or cause of death. But again, Hargrove did a slap shoddy work with it. He put himself in charge of the investigation. Coroners are not in charge of investigations, ladies and gentlemen. You have investigators at the police department or the sheriff's department. All coroners do is determine cause of death and look at all the crime scene photos and help with the investigation. They are not the lead investigators on cases. That is up to the police department. But apparently Hargrove has insinuated himself into all of these cases and determined that Ronnie Anderson killed himself, that Dan Anderson killed himself, that Nikki LeDoux killed herself, that Ted Swain, who the hell knows what happened with that young man?
Yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah, and the common denominator, ladies and gentlemen, is Hargrove. He is the common denominator in all four of these. In that county, you know, if it walks like a duck, it talks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, in my experience and my expertise, it is damn near a duck. Phyllis, would you agree with that?
I mean, quack, quack, baby. You got it. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. You are so right.
It slays me. And ladies and gentlemen, the way I met this young woman I have on the phone with me tonight is my friend Paige Roberts has her own radio show called Intercom Radio. And she sent me this note. She said, Yvonne, you need to hook up with Phyllis Cook. And I said, why? And she told me. I said, well, send her to me. Because Phyllis had been on Paige's show as well. And I said, send her to me. Well, when Phyllis came to me, all these other victims' families came to me and said, please tell our story too. There's another case in, say, the Mississippi, Louisiana. I've not talked to the young woman yet, but her daughter was shot in the chest and had her skull bashed in. But that was real suicide. Really? There's mm-hmm. no way it was suicide. She didn't knock herself in the head and then shoot herself in the chest. It didn't happen that way.
And just and, like on Bonnie, that Bonnie LeDoux, see, she talked to the same police department and the same coroner, and they told her the same thing that they told me, that as far as I know, there's nothing on her daughter's file, that it was washed out to Katrina, that whenever the storm came through, Katrina got everything. That is their story that they are telling everyone now that has an unsolved murder case there. Well, I'm sorry, ma'am, that we have no information on your family or your loved one. Katrina washed away everything. I mean, and this is such a...
What makes it even more interesting, Phyllis, is the background that I've done on her husband. Oh, God. She was one abused wife.
Yes.
I am a survivor of domestic abuse. I can see domestic abuse 10
yes,
miles
ma'am.
Down
Been
the
there,
road.
Done that. Yes,
I can
ma'am.
See it coming. She was and he killed her. I guarantee you, he killed her to keep her from leaving.
And, you know, in Mississippi, it's not what you know. It is definitely who you know.
Oh, absolutely.
It is. That's exactly how it is. If you know, they cover it up. And I mean, Gary Hargrove, I'm sorry, but like I told them, I have never met anyone as evil and corrupt in all my life. And to think that for 50 years, they knew that my brother was murdered. They could have saved me this problem. They could have given me the information. They could have given me those papers. But they knew that it was involving the mafia, and all of them was involved in it. Like I say, if you Google Dixie Mafia 1987 and read all the blogs, it tells the FBI called it the most corrupt state that they'd ever seen. The FBI knew of the sheriffs and the Roy Hobbs. They went to prison for all of it, but it was too late. They still never gave me any information.
And this is why I tell you, now you go to the state, you do FOIA requests, because all of that stuff is supposed to be sent on to the state. If it hasn't been sent to the state, they have broken the law.
Okay.
So send a FOIA request tomorrow to the state of Mississippi, to their Department of Vital Statistics, because or their CDC. I forget which one is on there, but I think they both are. But send it out And if they try to give you any grief, say, well, that my next correspondence to you will be a subpoena.
Yeah, because the only thing I got from them on my brother when I sent and requested all that, they just sent me his death certificate. They said that was all they had.
Isn't that convenient?
Yeah. They said the only thing they had was his death certificate.
And ladies and gentlemen, the death certificate says death by shotgun 410.
It says self-inflicted gunshot wound, a 410 gauge over and under at his residence. It gives the rest, and it said shotgun wound entering under the chin going up. And that was on my brother.
And I want to know how Hargrove knew it was a 410. If
okay, now Hargrove
no...
didn't handle that one.
Frank Hightower
handled that one.
I'm going brain stupid. How did Hightower
know? No, it's just
know...
so complicated.
How did Hightower know that if there was no physical evidence at the scene? He could not have known that with a certainty.
Yeah.
Let's put this in perspective, ladies and gentlemen. If I'm having a conversation with Phyllis and I say, Phyllis, over in that other room, there's a birthday cake. Go get it. Well, Phyllis goes in there, and there's no birthday cake. But Phyllis comes back and says, Yvonne, there's no birthday cake. But I go and tell everybody else, yes, there's a birthday cake in there. It's for somebody. There's a birthday cake in there. And so that's put on record. There was a birthday cake, but there's no physical evidence. It's the same thing. You can't be – you know what happens when you assume you make an ass out of you and me? That's what Hightower and Hargrove have done, is they have assumed things that weren't real because they only have to have 24 hours of training to be a coroner.
Why did they destroy the bullets? I mean, this is another thing. I told them I implicated my dad's murder. I mean, death is a murder the minute I got there. I knew my dad didn't commit suicide. 2 days later, on April the 22nd, he was killed on the 18th, or that's what I'm being told. He was killed on the 18th. On 4/22, and the only reason I know the dates is here a couple of months ago when I threatened to sue him, they sent me some papers. They sent me the narrative report, the detective investigative report on my dad. They sent me the fence report, the narrative report, and then they sent a form, the property invoice. It has three names on there, the bottom one being mine. And I kept looking at that handwriting, and I'm thinking, I've never seen this form. And now the two police officers that are dated give a badge number of 77 and then I guess a badge number of 4722 or whatever. But anyway, it says they're dated 4/22/03. It's 2 days after my dad was murdered. And then on the bottom, it's got Phyllis Cook, and I kept looking. I remember I had sent a lot of papers to them requesting information and stuff, so they had my signature. Someone signed this, and it signed so close to me that, you know, I knew someone had forged my name to the bottom of this paper, and it says that the shell casings and the bullets were destroyed. They were destroyed 2 days after my daddy's death. Him, a police officer, a lieutenant within the sheriff's department.
That brings up another point, because under the color of the blue line, as a general rule, cops will not stop until they figure out what happened,
mm-hmm.
especially to one of their own. And 2 days later, they destroyed the evidence. Why? Who's on the take in that police department?
You got it. Also, it states down here, on April the 22nd, 2003, Dan Anderson's daughter, a white female, Phyllis Cook, who resides in Georgia, traveled to the Gulfport Police Detective Division and met with Detective Lieutenant Brown concerning this matter. Cook afforded Lieutenant Brown the opportunity to view a living will of Dan Anderson, which indicated Phyllis Cook to be the heir. The only person that knew about that will was Roy Strickland, my dad's attorney. I did not carry a will with me when I went. I got a call around 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning telling me my daddy committed suicide. I was in a cast with my panty line down with just my toes sticking out, on crutches, had just had major surgery, was still doped up, not even supposed to be other than just walking to the bathroom and back to the bed, not even to be up. So I had to go tell my kids and grandkids what had happened. I leave for Gulfport right then. I barely grabbed some clothes. I don't even think I had two things that matched. I just grabbed some clothes and threw them in a suitcase and out the door. You know, we drove to Gulfport. We got there early that morning. So a will was the last thing that I had ever even thought of. A will was never taken back until I sold my dad's house 5 or 6 months later or whatever. I had to have the will for that. But, you know, that was a lie. I knew that that was a lie. And this attorney friend of my dad's, as I was going through some papers, I know he was involved in with the mafia bad, and now everything proves. I found in February of 2003, before my dad was killed, April the 18th, someone had cashed out my dad's life insurance policy. They had left two little policies of $3,000 each, which I helped use to bury him. It was not even enough to get him buried, but the big policy, it was cashed out. And
who cashed it out?
It was forged. The name was forged by dad, but it was by Roy Strickland. And I've had people, professional people, identify the signature as not my dad's signature. The signatures, I am working with Robert Wells with VAMPS, Victim of Homicide and Missing Murder People. He is helping with this, and his investigator there have confirmed that that was not my dad's signature. I've been working with Robert Wells and them for over a year now, almost a year now, and they're helping with this case. So, you know, they knew that that's not my dad's signature. Roy Strickland forged it. So whoever done it, they knew that when my dad confessed to me and my dad pointed out Jeffrey Bass in that Waffle House November the 27th of 2002, after 36 years, Jeffrey Bass was sitting behind me. And I don't know whether he looked at me and nodded to my dad or whether he did something that finally just had my dad snap, as people say. But for some reason, after 36 years, when Jeffrey, my dad mumbled SOB and the guy finally got up and left, well, when he left that Waffle House, my dad waited till he got far enough away that he knew I couldn't get up and go catch him. And my dad looked at me and he said, "Do you know who that was?" And I said, "No, Daddy, but I know you don't like him." First time now in 36 years, my dad looked at me and he said, "That's Jeffrey Bass." Said, "That's the old boy that killed Ronnie." Well, this was November the 27th of 2002. 4 months later, April the 18th, my dad was gunned down in his driveway, shot in the head just like my brother. Case ruled as a suicide. Well, they said his car was gone. His Masonic, my dad was a 33-degree Mason, shrine, everything. All this jewelry, his watch, everything, nice jewelry stuff, it was all gone. All the crystal, the china, the valuable things out of the house, all of them gone. His car was sold. So how in the hell, as you say, does somebody shoot himself, sell his car, pawn his jewelry, sell all of his dishes and his pot, you know, anything of any value, and still be there? It don't make sense.
There is, and there's no point in time from the time that you saw your father and had a meal with him in the Waffle House to the day of the shooting that he ever acted depressed, ever acted
no.
like he wanted to end it, acted like there's something wrong.
No, and right there on the corners are their autopsy on it. It states he was a white male, you know, gives his height and weight and all this, said, neat, clean clothes. He said he had on a white T-shirt and a button-up shirt, had on some blue jeans with a belt and the fly unbuttoned over some gray boxers. But it said his socks had grass and leaf matter, like stuff on the bottom of it. Well, when I read that, I got the evidence bag back out, and I said, something's not clicking here. So when I get the evidence bag out, I'm looking on my dad's socks, and oh my God, it looks like my dad had walked in the woods or out in the yard for a week. The bottom of the socks were just caked in stuff, and my dad had, I mean, he had a little, just a three-bedroom, one-bath, little brick house, but it was spotless. Everything was color-coordinated. Everything was just immaculate. You know, everything stayed so clean. And it stayed
well,
here. His nails was trimmed. So he was
the question
not depressed.
I have, the question I have, Phyllis, is mm-hmm. this. Why? Now let's think about this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
The belt of his pants were undone, the button was undone, the zipper was down, and he had on socks that had looked like they'd been through three world wars.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Now, there's two or three scenarios. One, he was asleep, but why would he take the time to have a button-up shirt on? He was asleep, he heard something, jumped up, threw his clothes on, and maybe he had his socks on, maybe he had his shoes off, so he runs outside to walk the perimeter. Two, he is asleep in the house. Someone comes in. He is forced to dress, and for whatever reason is walked through God's green acres without his shoes. Maybe they got scared as he was putting his shoes on and said, just come on and forget the shoes. Why would a man who was neat, he was clean shaven, his hair was neat, his nails were neat, his clothes were neat, his house were neat, why would he go outside in the front driveway in front of everybody and God and shoot himself?
Okay, now the way, and I've thought about this, and knowing my dad, knowing the incidents and the things that have taken place up to bring up to the point of where he was murdered, I do not think, and I think that is one of the reasons that my dad, the bullets and the shell casings they destroyed, for the simple fact is, I told them, my dad did not shoot himself with that gun. That gun was not what was used. I think my dad was taken somewhere else and shot and brought back for the simple fact of on my dad's blue jeans, it has the blood spatter from the knees going down toward his feet out to the back as if he was on a kneeling position whenever he was shot. In the autopsy diagnosis, it says one recent gunshot wound to the head entering the right temple, contact exiting the left temple through the brain, no bullet in the wound. Blood spatter and powder particles on both hands. That's a defense maneuver right then. The minute I read that, I saw my dad throw up both hands to block his face. Then
yep.
It says contusion, abrasion of the left partial scalp and the right front toe. Okay, if my dad had on his socks and everything white and he had shot himself and just fallen down or straight down or either to the side, why would he have contusions on his feet with his socks on there? Unless he was drugged somewhere. I think my dad was shot somewhere else and brought back. It's the reason no neighbors or no one heard anything, because when I got there early, that he was shot, say, supposedly around 4:30 on that Friday afternoon. I got there wee hours of the Saturday morning when I found out. After I left the funeral home, I went straight to my dad's. I got out. There's a picture on my Facebook page, and it shows the house. Now, it has my Jeep, because this was taken, there was a hurricane or storm, I think Andrew or one of them, that came through, and I was up there with my dad during that time. I went to stay with him through the storm because he wouldn't leave. So, but anyway, it's his Jeep, my Jeep, Cherokee, his Lincoln, and then the Cadillac. Well, right there behind my Jeep Cherokee, the monkey grass starts on a concrete mm-hmm. driveway. Now, there are some leaves and things in the yard blown down from the storm, but where that monkey grass starts right there behind my Jeep is where I was told that my dad was lying. Well, you know, when you run over a dog or a cat or anything in the road, coon, whatever, it leaves blood spatter
yep.
or blood on the road. There was nothing. There was none washed out into the grass that I could see. Now, there was a little trace of some blood there, and there was a piece of, I guess you could say, brain matter or tissue, you know, skin tissue there that I did notice that in a little bit into the grass. So when I questioned Gary Hargrove about this, I said, you know, Gary, I don't see any blood. I don't see anything indicating my dad shot himself here. And he said, oh, Phyllis, he said, I had to get the police department, I mean, the fire department out there. He said, they washed away everything. No, I don't think my dad was shot there. I think my dad was shot somewhere else, and he was brought back and thrown out at the driveway there. It's the reason that There's no blood tissue. The reason nobody heard anything. Now, of course, like I say, nobody heard anything from 2003 up until a couple of months ago, and I got the fabricated reports and stuff that says there were four witnesses, but nobody heard or saw anything, you know.
Exactly. Well, sadly, Phyllis, I hate to do this, but we are getting ready to run out of time.
Okay, honey, that's fine. No, I appreciate this.
But you're coming back. You are coming back. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is one of the books that I'm working on. It is a true crime. It really happened. So stay tuned for that and say a lot of prayers for Phyllis and the other victims' families, because they are victims too. And this has been Phyllis's mission for a long, long time. And even if we don't get justice in the court system, we're going to get justice in the book. And Phyllis, I'm going to change the dynamic of this show and go in and change the title and everything so that everybody can know that it's us tonight, and then I'll tag you in this show after we go off air. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back on air Wednesday night. I did not bring my book back here, so I don't know what wonderful guests we're going to have, but it's going to be a jam-packed week, I guarantee you. And as with all things, y'all know my passion is giving a voice to the victims. It is very important to me because they can no longer speak for themselves. And I do not like to see injustice in the world. It really makes me angry that we have this injustice. So look up Phyllis on my page. She has Murder in Mississippi. Join that page. And remember what I always say, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to achieve greatness in your life, stop asking permission. Because if you ask permission, you're not going to get it. And just like Phyllis, if you have a passion in your life, or you feel there's an injustice in your life, or someone in your family has been done an injustice, don't ask permission. Just find the answers. And then send it to me and I'll write about it. We'll get them justice, even if it's just in the book. Don't just feel special, ladies and gentlemen. Be special. When you get up and look at yourself in the mirror in the morning, don't say, I feel special today. No, you look in the mirror and say, I am special today. Because if you just feel special, you'll never be special. And I always say this, and y'all know this, because you've listened to the show for a long, long time. Your smile is your logo. Your personality is your business card. And how you leave others feeling after having had an experience with you, ladies and gentlemen, that becomes your business card. And as y'all have seen tonight, Harrison County's business card is not doing well at all. Because the experience that the victim's families has had with that county and good old Mississippi leaves a very bad taste in my mouth. And I want to tell y'all real quick that just on this show alone, we are up to 27,833 listeners. And ladies and gentlemen, when you include all the podcasts this goes up on in over 70 countries, we are at 40,554 listeners. So, Phyllis, your story is getting out there, my friend.
Fantastic.
And thank you, my darling, for calling in and for stepping in since my guest, for whatever reason, didn't show up tonight. And get me the rest of your stuff, and you know that this show will be going up on SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Spreaker, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, FM.com, Podcast Garden, Podcast.com, and several others that I don't even know about.
And this is fantastic. And like I say, Mississippi, you know, Murdered in Mississippi is just a title, but the story and my pain is real.
Absolutely. And with your permission, that's what I want to title the book is Murdered in Mississippi.
That is fantastic.
Okay, y'all
because
heard it first. Absolutely. So, ladies and gentlemen, that is the title of the book. It's called Murdered in Mississippi, and it will be coming out probably next year if I can get it done this year. But y'all know when I write true crime, I take my time because I don't say anything but the facts. So thank you, my darling Phyllis, for calling in and being a wonderful guest in telling your story, and we're going to keep telling the story. So, ladies and gentlemen, join us on Wednesday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. I am your host, Yvonne Mason, with my guest, Phyllis Cook. And we will return with Off the Chain on Wednesday night, 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. Join us. Learn things. Good night, everyone.
Thanks, honey. Thanks.
You are welcome, my darling. And hang on just a minute when
yeah,
the show
I will,
goes
hold
dark.
On. Go ahead.
Okay. The show is now dark, but anything we say, of course, is going up in the archives. But I'm going to change out the synopsis of the show and the title of the show. And as soon as it goes up in archives, which should be in just a little while, I'll put it on Facebook and tag you in it. Then tomorrow, okay. When I put it up on the 5 podcast, I'll put those links up and tag you in it and put it everywhere.
Great, fantastic. And there's so much more. And like I say, once I get the rest of the autopsy reports and all this stuff next week or whatever they'll send me, then we'll go from there. But I'm going to sit down and try to do a story on, do it just on Ronnie first so I won't confuse you, about how he grew up and the things that happened and everything that I can think of up to his murder there. And then I'll do the same with Daddy.
Okay, sounds good to me, honey.
All right, honey, you have a good night.
You too. Talk
Thanks.
To you later, darling.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.